Hello to everybody. When I was asked to present an overview of Lattice QCD computing at this conference, I tried to figure out what was the best way to introduce the subject, and I thought that maybe I could start the provocative way, like this, or maybe I could apply some degree of self-criticism and correct this in this other way. And this is certainly a joke, but it has some degree of truth. And let me explain this for a second. Well, all of this conference has been concerned with a number of important issues in in computing for high-energy physics. I mean, we have to learn how to move enormous amount of data from one point to the next. We have to store data in a way that we can retrieve it in an efficient way. We have to cope with programs which will live much longer than the average lifetime of a postdoc, as a postdoc, I mean. And but there is one and all this we in Lattice QCD computing we do not care. So we are old-fashioned. But there is something that you, in some sense, the people involved in experiment, do not care at all any longer, and which is the critical point for us, and it is sheer CPU power. I mean, you can assume that in experimental physics that CPU power is there any time you want it, but we cannot. Simply because in Lattice QCD, the amount of computing power that we need is represented by a graph like this. This graph, well, you should ignore the bottom of it, clearly doesn't. It's sort of anticipation. This graph was first designed some years ago by Norman Criss of Columbia University. He went in the library and looked through the collections of nuclear physics and tried to figure out how many CPU cycles, which in our case are essentially the same as floating point operation, were needed to get the physical results, which were then published in a state-of-the-art paper at the time, which is shown here. This is simply the number of operations, and here it is shown in a more understandable way as the time, as the performance of your computer times the time you wait. So in the middle 80s, if you had a 1 gigaflops computer, which you did not have at that time, you just started the program today, and tomorrow you wrote your preprint. In the year 92, if you had a 1 teraflops computer, which you did not have, you could start your program today and write your paper tomorrow. And this thing is going on, and the point is that this is the amount of computer power which is needed by a group of not 500 people or 1,000 people, but a group of maybe 4, 5, 6 people. So you see that CPU power is still in this field the most important issue, and people are ready to kill to get more CPU power for Lattice QCD computing. Okay, now you might want to ask why, what do we do with all of this? And since there is a P in this conference, let me put a couple of physics transparencies here. Well, what you want to do is compute, well, phenomenological quantities in QCD from first principles, simply because you don't know yet of approximation methods, which allow you in interesting situation, in a physically important situation, which loosely speaking, amount to say that the momenta you are interested in are around the lambda QCD scale, where you have no way to compute things except that going back to your quantum mechanics class and write down the operator and compute matrix elements of the operator, which, being this a field theory, are expressed as some weighted average over the fields. The fields which I denote by phi are simply the things which describe the quarks, the gluons, and so on. Now, since you can't do that with paper and pencil on the back of the envelope, you take this and put it on a computer, and instead of having real fields at every point, you put discrete set of fields at a discrete set of time and of space-time points, so that you have a finite amount of variables that you then start to chart on your computer, and essentially what you have to do is a Monte Carlo computation in which you get a configuration according to some probability. This is much more easily said than done, but I will not go into the details at all. And then you compute one matrix the value of the operator on this field, and then you average over that for as much time as needed to get good statistics. This is another important point. Now, a good operator, something which gives you some physical interesting point, this is just an example, I mean, I will immediately skip all of this, is the thing which creates, say, a nucleon at point zero and kills the same nucleon at point x and time t. Now, if you average over the x positions, then you get a nucleon which is steady, as zero momentum, and therefore its energy is the mass, so it behaves like this. So by measuring this quantity and fitting it to this very simple expression, you measure the mass. You compute from basic principle the mass of the nucleon, which is something which people would like to know. And this is just an example. Now, why is so much computing power needed? Well, the reason why you need so much computing power is that you're making an approximation. And the approximation is, of course, the discretization, if you want. This is a sort of sketch. You don't have a continuous of point, you have just discrete set of point, and you are putting, so to speak, your physical systems on it. And of course, you want the spacing between your points in the lattice to be much smaller than the heaviest particle. More technically, you want the spacing to be smaller than the Compton length of the heaviest particle. But you want the box to be big enough so that all your particles feel comfortable there. And so you want the size of your box to be large enough. But the two things are connected together by the fact that the size of the box is simply how many elementary points you put, and it is this thing here. So if you make A small, then L becomes small, and if you make L large, then A becomes too large, unless the number of points is very, 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 very much larger than one, which is why you need all this of computing. Fine. So, okay, people have been working for years on this, using the amount of computer power that I've shown you before. So did they get anything interesting? Did they get the values for the masses of the hadrons? Well, yes. This is, for instance, a recent result which gives you an idea of the masses of the baryons. Here you see the experimental values. Here you see computed values. I will not go into the detail of how you compute these. And I also have to apologize to a number of people whose results are not being described in this and the next talk and in the next transparencies. I don't want to make a review, of course, of results, but just flash you some of the point of overlap between lattice QCD and experimental high energy physics. So you see, you may be happy after all, you are getting all of these numbers within 10%, but it's sort of frustrating. I mean, you can simply go to CERN, open the data particle booklet, and you get all this number with all of this accuracy. So this is clearly a basic problem. I mean, QCD has to provide this number, but it may be a sort of, clearly there's a lot of work to go in this direction. So you better try to compute something which is not as well known. So let me show you another quantity which people are able to extract from the lattice. This is work done by the DAISY group, and a number of people from DAISY, they have computed the running coupling constant in QCD. This is something which has direct impact on experiments, and they have, let me show you their results. You see the dashed line. This is what perturbation theory is able to provide for you, which has to be true as the scale becomes larger and larger. And is true in the sense that, okay, theoretical lattice computation agrees, of course, at this site. But then you see that as you go to smaller and smaller momenta, the thing starts to diverge. So you see, you have here good control of a quantity which you know to compute in a different way. But you also have the first hints that as you go down, you're going to find something different, which you may eventually use for, I mean, just to understand what's the fragmentation of hadrons are. Do you want something even, so to speak, less known? Well, what you ideally, as experimentalists, would like from a theoretical physicist is a prediction of a number which you can measure and which is predicted before it is measured. And lattice QCD is starting to be able to do this in the world of weak interaction of the lattice. This is the quantity which you see here is FD. FD is the lepton decay constant of a D meson, the quantity that fixes the width of this decay mode, for instance, just one. And the number here are the prediction of the people, of several group working in lattice gauge theory. All these numbers, as you see, more or less agree with the world average that you are getting, that has been obtained recently by several experiments. And it's important to notice this, because this value was some of the comments are Italian, but the important point to notice, or the nice point to notice, is that this number was predicted before this measurement way. So we are now starting, after 10 years or 15 years of lattice QCD, to be able to provide numbers which have to match the experimental number. If they don't match, then the experiment is wrong, of course. So we should be very happy of that, and we are very happy. Not everybody is happy. Certainly everybody in physics is happy, but other people think it in a different way, just to keep on this self-criticism. And this magazine, 1 year ago, made a cover story on computing. And among other things, they noticed that there are branches of science in which it is not too sensible to wonder whether researchers have run out of sound ways to use all the computation at their fingertips. So these are the magazines which are read by the people to whom we apply for money. So, well, it may be difficult. And but anyway, we don't agree with this kind of statement. And in fact, a good way to show this is to put this list of computers that physicists have been building in the last 15 years for expressly for lattice QCD computation. Now, you may ask, well, why didn't they use the computers that we may get from standard manufacturers? Were they not available? Were not they able to provide the performance? Well, barely able they were, technically. The point here is that the best computer, the fastest computer that you can prove to exist on Earth is typically either too expensive, and then the people who read this magazine don't agree that physicists should have one, or maybe it's locked in some weapon lab where it is not available. So physicists have to do something else, and what they do is they build their computers. And there is a very long story of machines which have been developed by physicists. And the first group is the late 80s. It's not an unexhaustive, so I apologize for everybody who is not in this list, but it's a good sort of representation. And in the late 80s, there was the Columbia group, which made, built a QCD machine as the group of INFN APE, and there was an early version of the Japanese machine. Then in the early 90s, the performance level went up by a factor 10, and there were more entries. There were a second generation of both the Italian and the Columbia machine. GF11 from IBM Yorktown came in. There was an effort from the Fermilab Computer Center, ACP Max, and there was another Japanese machine, QCD PAX. In the late 90s, there are a sort of third generation set of machines, which is the CS PAX, again, the Japanese effort. 0.8 teraflops machine, which is yet another name for the Columbia collaboration, and then UPMIL, the next UPE or INFN effort. Plus, and these were, machines which were designed, built, and got physics out of it. And physics is starting to come out of this generation. And they were essentially all good successes. Then there was something else. There were attempts at building larger collaborations, things which went beyond QCD physicists who could agree what was the purpose of a machine. And there was at least one such effort in the US, and there was another similar effort in Europe, the European Teraflop Initiative. And all of these amounted to, I don't know, in the US, but certainly in Italy, it amounted in making the airlines happy by buying tickets to Brussels and then coming back home and going back to Brussels again, and then at some point getting fed up with going to Brussels where the food is not that good. Okay. This just shows you that this machine, that people were so much interested in the game that they tried to do it on by their own. And here you can show the same thing in a different way. I'm borrowing this transparency from the WW page of the Japanese CD PAX machine. And all the things in the previous line are in fact parallel computers. And as you see, parallel computers started to develop early enough that up to some time they were certainly overwhelmed in performance by vector computers. But now it looks like the crossover point has really passed. And now nobody in the 80s, we were sort of considered as crazy thinking of parallel computing, while I think nobody now has any doubt that this is the right way to do. So there is a question open. How is it that physicists, or even theoretical physicists, those who are not able to switch properly their desktop computer on, were successful in building and running physics on this on dedicated computers? Well, let's keep this question open, and I will try to answer it in the next 15 minutes. Let me first give you my contribution to the museum that you will be visiting this evening. I have to leave, so I won't have the opportunity. So here are two pieces which might go into the museum. Here is the first generation of UPE about 1985. As you see, this is a bricolage kind of machine, and the only real professional part of it was the scope, which was near to it for most of the time. But still, this machine was successful, and there was a lot of physics out of it. A couple of years later, GF11 came out. This is the IBM Yorktown, so it has to be a little bit more professional, and the cabinets are certainly beautiful. You see here a processing board, and these four little tiny blobs that you see here are 5 megaflops computing units. So a board like this contained all the glue logic, which enabled 4 or 5 megaflops data path to work. So you see you have gone a lot of way out. And the reason why I'm selecting this one for my gallery in the museum is that I think this is the most beautiful piece of homemade computer that has ever been built. I think it's a monument to human intelligence. But it had a flaw, and the flaw is this one. Let me put this back. And GF11 is here. But GF11 was proposed here. So Don Weingarten, the person who is behind this project, in 83 or 84, promised to build a 10 gigaflops computer, which was certainly beyond the technology at that time. And eventually, it went down to lie exactly on the proper line. So this is a warning: you must never do anything which is too much beyond the natural grow line. And well, Don is certainly a person very loyal to his company, so he never confirmed the story, but it should have been like that. But Don went to some top IBM manager saying, making a case that a 1 gigaflops computer, one lying on the proper line, could be built for QCD, and trying to support his case, he said that something similar was going to be built in Italy. And this was his error. The top IBM manager sort of started and said, look, if those guys are building a 1 gigaflop computer, then you have to build a 10 gigaflop computer. So you will do that. But, and that's the end of the story. So let's going back to serious thing. The question is, how comes that we can do that? Well, the situation is this, that lattice QCD is a trivial problem for parallel computing at the architecture level. Well, what you have to do is you have to map physically close pieces of the real world, of the physical world, into neighboring processor, into which are arranged in a topology, which can be as simple as a grid. And then this is the back of it. The background is just field theory. So whatever you have to do is you have to move data only to nearest processors, to nearest physical point, which means to nearest processors. And then you have translation invariants, which is again physics. And so the same program has to go on all nodes, on all processors. And the same load will, on average, be experienced by all nodes. So all the ingenuity, all the effort to make parallel computing simple for the user, which, for instance, we are discussing in the beautiful talk which was presented before, are really not needed for QCD. And also another point is that since the basic objects are C number or C matrices, then there is a large ratio of operation over operand. So you take a number from memory, you can do a lot of computing. There's a lot of computing you have to do to it before you need a new data. And all this feature, of course, make parallel processing straightforward. So it's very simple collection of processor is what you need. But you have to solve a second problem. The second problem is the caching problem. Let me give you the basic architectural point in a very simple situation. And of course, people then become smarter and do more complex things. And well, basically, if you have a cache, you have a system that makes the assumption that data are available at essentially no time, with no time penalty when needed, because you assume it is in the cache. But this, of course, doesn't work when you have cycle of computation in which you sweep over gigabytes of data. So unless your cache is several gigabytes in size, you have no way, so it's really main memory, you have no way to make that the hit rate of a cache is such that the cache is important, is useful. Then you have a way out of this, which means you have to prefetch data from memory before you use it, early enough that they can be used. And this works better if it is done to some extent under program control, where program control may mean anything. May mean you writing the appropriate code, or maybe the compiler doing it for you. So a lattice QCD machine has to solve these and only these two problems. All the other problems which were addressed before are really not a damage, of course, but are not really necessary for it. So, for instance, a typical machine like that is in architecture something like UP100. UP100 was a very simple structure of a certain number of nodes which were arranged at the edges of a three-dimensional grid, and you can put, well, from 8 to a couple of thousand processors on the system. And the nodes were able to run, all execute the same program. I mean, there was no need to run different programs at different places. And we're only able to move data to their nearest neighbor, which is what you have to do in QCD. So the situation was very simple. The architecture was straightforward. The connection were as simple as possible. And the control was as simple as possible. Okay, now let's go to the present. So this was a machine which was built in the early 90s, 91, 92, and is now in use in several places. So we can think what is new. So what are the machines which will become are becoming available right now? And so let me give a brief overview of three of these. If I can go back to the previous slide, which makes a list of them. Okay, so these three beasts here. And although I will use a slightly different order. The first one is the Japanese effort, CP-PAX. This is an effort which was led by physicists, mainly at the University of Tsukuba, and in collaboration with Hitachi, the big company. And what they did, what they needed for physics, was, of course, an array of processors, which are the red blocks, able to move data across among each other. Of course, they were making a collaboration with a company who had some wider interest. So they came out with this beautiful structure in which the lines that you see in the X, Y, and Z direction are not just grids, but are crossbars. So if you have to move data from one point to any other point, you just have to move to the X crossbar, then jump onto the Y crossbar, and then finally jump onto the Z crossbar, which brings you to destination. So this is a simple three-dimensional architecture with shortcuts in any of the three directions, and therefore it is certainly more than needed for QCD, but of course QCD can be put efficiently on this machine. And if you look at the dimensions, it is 16 by 8 by 17, and the 17, which is a sort of odd number, is simply because you want one layer of the system to be in charge of in fact, the bottom layer in the design to be in charge of IOs to disks to external world to be sure that data can flow in and out of the machine as much as possible. So the architecture the parallel part of the architecture is fine for QCD. How did they solve this cache miss problem? Well, they came out with this very interesting situation in which they started using HP processors, and a normal HP processor would only be this line in which you have 32 registers which you can use for your computation. But they added a much larger physical set of registers, and they added the possibility to move a window of active registers over the physical registers. So what you do is you perform your computation on the, let me call it the current window, while at the same time you store to memory the result of a previous computation which overlaps over it. And at the same time you preload the data which would be used in the next loop, if you wish. So this is a very clean way to solve the problem that I mentioned before, without modifying or with little extension to a basic known architecture. So this machine is able to run any standard program running on the HP, Unix, for instance, and it can also perform efficiently on QCD. Bunch of numbers. Top speed, peak performance is 600 gigaflops with 2,000 processing units, and the memory is here. These essentially are the two quantities which are important for the high energy physicist, along with a reasonable data transfer across the links. And we may read this number just to show what the electricity bill will be for you to run this machine. Let's move to APE. APE is a little bit simpler in the structure. It is the basic structure is more or less the same. It is an array of processors which are arranged on a grid, but this time the grid is a real grid. So the physical and the best performing computation go from one processor to the next processor. And If you want to go far away, then you have to hop across the processor. The machine will do it for you, but it will take some time. But again, this is not what we need most of the time. We just need nearest neighbor communication. And then you build a very big machine out of this, and then you have a sort of heavy, a huge machine that you can run on one single program. That's nice, because most of your programs are very large, but sometimes you want to split the machine into independent blocks to handle smaller problems in parallel, or to develop new programs. So we tried to make it a sort of more general machine by giving the capability to split it into independent blocks, which can be either glued together to a big array or independently handled by, if you want, an I/O interface, which is simply a PC. We are a small group, we cannot afford to rewrite Unix or to do other things, so we build a simple interface to a PC, and then we get everything from standard PC, and we run Linux on it just because it's the simplest thing to modify and use. The other problem, memory access and prefetch. Well, we do it in the heavy way. I mean, we simply build our processor, which is optimized for floating point computation, and as a set of 512 physical registers which can be independently addressed. So we are somehow making a cache, if you want, a first level cache, which is completely controlled by the program, which is essentially what allows you to specify in the program that you have to prefetch data to some point. Let's put a few numbers on it. As you see, many are rather similar to the previous one, except that we have been forced to use a lower clock frequency because the technology available is not as good as it was available for the Japanese machine. And the data transfer rate per link is similar, but the latency to start up a new communication is very good, of the order of a few hundred nanoseconds for a very large machine. This is easy in our case because we don't need to run a protocol, and we don't have contention, but it's a good result anyway. Third and even simpler machine is the machine produced designed by the Columbia Group, which is very similar, except that it has they have made two choices. First, you make it a four-dimensional grid, so you really fit the geometry of a machine to the geometry of a physical problem at hand. And the computing node is a very cheap and inexpensive signal processor. It is a 50 megaflops processor that you can buy for about $50. And so the choice is take the cheapest floating point performance, build a machine which is tailored exactly to the physical problem, and assemble these. And of course, what you have to do is that you need to go to the floating point performance that they like, of the order of about 400 gigaflops. They need 16K processors. So this is a machine which would be a nightmare to use in any other field rather than QCD, but in QCD it does exactly the job that we know. So can we make a sort of comparison between these three machines? Well, peak speed is very good for all of them. Within a factor two, they are in the teraflop range. Well, I neglect the small difference that our machine is not yet ready, but it will be in some months from now. So all of these will be in the 500 gigaflop teraflop range. And as you see, there are sort of two philosophies start to come out. There is the very heavy, very large number of nodes for Columbia, and then a more traditional number for Apenil and CSPAX. And this machine is again really dedicated in the sense that the topology of a network really makes it easy to use it for QCD, make it difficult to use for other things. Okay, fine. While Apenil is something intermediate, it is okay for QCD, but it is okay for fluid dynamics, for instance, while CSPAX is a very general structure. Again, the bandwidth is something which, again, is closely fit for QCD, average for Apenil, and good for CSPAX. And again, the programming. I mean, programming is, I didn't address any programming issues in this talk, and this is somehow a message. I mean, programs are very simple and straightforward, so they are not a real problem in our field. But the environment are again a little bit comfortable here, medium comfortable for Apenil, and dedicated for Columbia. Then there are the two lines. The two lines are, if you want, there are two entries, industry involvement and QCD focus. And the two entries are very much correlated. This is a 100% research project with very little industry involvement, if any, and completely focused on QCD. With some small industry involvement, we can do something which is a little bit more general, while if you bring in a large computer company, you achieve something which is fine for QCD and can be used for certainly for several other applications. And this brings me to a conclusion that, I mean, the question that you may ask is this going to continue? I mean, are you going to have an overview of lattice QCD computing and covering dedicated machines in the year 2000? That's of course is a hard question to answer. We could ask the first speaker this morning, but well, let me give you my own conclusions. And the first are very easy, and that physicists have been building their toy supercomputers for more than 10 years. And they have provided the processing power needed by QCD at affordable prices for the physicists. This is the key issue. But these systems are becoming increasingly complex. And therefore, there are two avenues which might be covered. One is that physicists find a way to strike agreement with computer companies to work together. Fair agreement, what it means? It means that physicists come along and say, look, I have a simple, heavily parallel, heavily number-crunching oriented program. If you have in mind to build a high-performance parallel supercomputer, then we can provide you a sort of test bench. And if you find this reasonable, then this is the way we might go together. So we are the first users of systems which are not usable by the average application, but it's fine for us. And this seems to be the Japanese way. Or you go the other way around. You say, if I stick exactly to the minimum requirements which are needed for QCD, then I focus on it and I spare on everything else, then I can certainly build new generation machine, which are, say, one order of magnitude more cost-effective for QCD than, for instance, the machine, which the beautiful machine which was discussed in the previous talk. And so I don't see any other way than going in one or the other direction. Which of the two will be covered, if any, then this we will see at the next two or three Lattice conferences. Thank you.